In the upper halls of Wintermere House, the crying never stops. Two infant sons of a widowed duke, motherless, inconsolable, rejecting every hand that reaches for them. Physicians have failed. Nursemaids have wept and given notice. The most educated governess in the county cannot give these boys a single night of peace. Then she approaches Pauline, poor, parentless, the parish girl the whole household laughs at. The one who came from nothing, owns nothing, and was never supposed to be anywhere near the Duke's sons. She was told to stand by the wall. She did not stand by the wall, and the crying stopped. Now the boys won't let her go. They hear her footstep before she enters the room. They reach for her before she speaks. They refuse every other hand. The household has no explanation for it. The Duke has no name for what he is beginning to feel, and Pauline has no idea what she has just stepped into. Something is awakening inside Wintermere House, something quiet and stubborn and entirely unbothered by class. And it started the moment a rejected maid walked into a room full of grief and simply refused to look away. The rain came sideways at Wintermere House. It always did, in November. It did not fall so much as hurl itself against the tall stone walls, against the lid-paned windows, against the iron gates that marked the boundary between the world outside and the world within. And the world within Wintermere House was its own country, grand, cold, and absolutely still in all the ways that mattered. The candles along the upper corridor trembled in their brackets, not from wind. The windows were sealed. They trembled because the house was old, and the stone breathed, and because Wintermere House had not known peace in 14 months, not since the night the Duchess died, not since the night the crying began. It started before midnight, as it always did. It crept through the upper floors first, thin and sharp, like something tearing. Then it widened, deepened, doubled. Because there were two of them, there had always been two of them from the very first breath, twin sons. Theodore and Arthur Vaughan, heirs to the Dukedom of Wintermere, born into a house that had not finished grieving long enough to welcome them. The servants heard it from the kitchen. A footman named Terence paused mid-step on the back staircase and pressed his eyes shut for one brief moment before continuing down. In the laundry room, two of the housemaids exchanged a look that required no words. Above the scullery, in her narrow room beside the linen press, old Mrs. Mabel Clark, the housekeeper, set down her mending and listened. The crying did not stop. It never stopped. It had been this way since the twins were 3 weeks old, when every physician in the county had already come and gone, when every nursemaid had tried and failed, when the governess, Miss Cordelia Shaw, had declared the boys difficult in a voice that made the word sound like an accusation directed at the infants themselves. They were not ill, the physician said. They were not hungry. They were not cold. There was no reason for it, medically speaking. The servants had their own explanations. They said the boys were born under sorrow. That their mother, Duchess Adelaide Vaughan, had given her last breath so they could draw their first. And perhaps that kind of entrance into the world left a mark. They whispered it in the laundry. They murmured it across the kitchen table. They pressed it into the corners of the house, the way a cold draft finds every crack. 14 months of crying, 14 months of physicians and nurses, and heated opinions and failed solutions. 14 months of Desmond Vaughan, Duke of Wintermere, standing outside the nursery door at midnight, one hand flat against the carved oak, unable to go in. He stood there now. He was not a small man. He filled the corridor the way a storm fills a valley, completely, with a quality of weight that had nothing to do with physical size. He was broad-shouldered and lean, with the kind of jaw that suggested he had never once said anything he did not mean. His dark hair was uncombed. His coat was still on, which meant he had not been to bed. His hand pressed against the door, as if steadying himself against something that could knock him down. From inside, the crying continued. He heard Theodore first. Theodore's cry was always the higher one, the one with the quality of a question in it. Arthur's followed, lower and more insistent, a sound that did not ask but demanded. Together, they made a sound that travelled up through the floor and into the chest of everyone in the house, and sat there, aching. Desmond closed his eyes. Behind the closed lids, he was not in the corridor. He was in this same room 14 months ago, standing at the foot of a bed instead of a door. Adelaide had been so still by then. Still in a way that did not look like sleep. Her hands had been folded across the coverlet, her lips slightly parted, the color already leaving her, in the time it took a candle to burn down a quarter inch. The midwife had said something, the physician had said something else, and then a different sound had entered the room. Not one cry, but two, overlapping, insisting, alive, and Desmond had turned toward them with a face that did not know what expression it was supposed to wear. He had not known how to hold joy and loss in the same pair of hands. He still did not. He straightened now, drew his hand from the door, and walked back down the corridor toward the east wing. He did not go in. He did not trust himself to go in. The nursery still smelled of lavender and warm milk, and something else beneath both of those things. Something faint and sweet and entirely Adelaide, and he was not ready. He was never ready. Below stairs in the scullery, Pauline Roberts was bent over a basin of steaming water up to her elbows. The water was too hot. It always was at the end of the day, when the fires had been stoked high for the evening and the kitchen had been running since before dawn. Pauline's fingers had gone from pink to red to a deep, aching scarlet over the course of the past hour. She did not complain. Complaining below stairs at Wintermere House was a luxury reserved for people whose positions were secure enough to survive it. Pauline's position was not secure. It had never been secure. She was the parish girl. That was how they referred to her when they were being polite about it. She had come from the St. Bridget's poorhouse in the village of Ashfield, where she had lived from the age of 7 until the age of 16, when Mrs. Clark had come looking for a scullery maid and had taken Pauline on a trial basis that had somehow stretched into 3 years. She had no family name that mattered, no connections that could protect her, no savings that could cushion a fall. She had two dresses, a pair of boots that had been resoled twice, a small wooden comb her mother had given her before she died, and a knowledge of how to work without stopping that had been trained into her bones at St. Bridget's before she was old enough to fully understand what work meant. She was not tall, but she was not small. She had brown hair that she kept pinned back under her cap, and eyes that were a clear, pale grey, the kind of eyes that seemed to take in more than they gave away. Her face was plain in the way that good things are plain, honest, without pretense, the features arranged with a quiet that could be mistaken for emptiness by people who did not look carefully. Most people at Wintermere House did not look carefully at Pauline. Roberts, the voice came from the doorway, sharp and unhurried at the same time, which was a skill Miss Cordelia Shaw had developed over years of wielding her education like a weapon. Pauline straightened and turned. Cordelia Shaw was standing in the scullery doorway in her governess grey, her dark hair arranged in precise coils, her chin lifted to an angle that communicated her permanent awareness of the distance between herself and anyone below her. She was not old, perhaps 30, but her expression had settled into lines that made her seem ageless in the way of carved stone. "The basin by the window has not been emptied," Cordelia said. "Again, I'll see to it directly, Miss Shaw. You'll see to it now." Cordelia let her eyes travel slowly down and back up. "I wonder sometimes what precisely you do manage to complete satisfactorily. The floor in the east corridor had streaks this morning. Cook says you were slow with the breakfast coppers. And yet here you stand, dripping water onto my clean tiles as though the house runs itself." Pauline pressed her cracked hands flat against her apron. "I'll empty the basin now, Miss Shaw. See that you do. Cordelia turned, paused, and do something about those hands, Roberts. It is unpleasant to look at. She left. Pauline stood still for a moment, her jaw set, her eyes on the middle distance. Then she crossed to the window basin, lifted it with both burning hands, and carried it out without spilling a drop. From two floors above them, the crying continued. Pauline heard it as she moved through the back corridor. She always heard it. The whole house heard it, but most people heard it the way they heard the rain. As background, as inconvenience, as something to be endured or ignored, Pauline heard it differently. She could not have explained why. She only knew that when the twins cried, something in her chest answered. An old, half-remembered pain that lived in the part of her that remembered St. Bridget's, where small children cried at night in the long dormitory room, and no one came. No one ever came. She set the basin outside the kitchen door and stood for a moment in the narrow doorway, the cold night air against her hot face. The crying wove itself into the rain. Two voices, small and exhausted and relentless. Clark appeared at her shoulder. The housekeeper was a compact woman of 50, with the bearing of someone who had learned authority young and wore it, so naturally it no longer looked like effort. She pressed a small cloth, soaked in cool water, into Pauline's hand without comment. "For your fingers," she said. "Thank you, Mrs. Clark. Don't thank me. Take it as a warning. You'll need those hands intact when morning comes." She paused, her eyes on the ceiling for a moment, tracking the sound above them. "The nursemaid sent down again an hour ago, the usual requests. Warm cloths, fresh linen, chamomile water that does nothing whatsoever. Is His Grace?" "His Grace stands in the corridor and does not go in," Mrs. Clark said, her voice flat and without judgment, as though she were reporting the weather. "As he has done for 14 months. Pauline wrapped the cool cloth around her knuckles and said nothing. "Mrs. Clark looked at her for a moment with the expression she reserved for things she had opinions about, but knew better than to voice directly. Then she said, "Don't let Cordelia Shaw make a habit of speaking to you that way in front of the others. Once it is a habit, it becomes invisible. She speaks the truth. I was slow with the coppers. She speaks it to wound, which is a different thing entirely." "Mrs. Clark turned back toward the kitchen. "Finish here and go to bed, Pauline. The house will still be crying in the morning." Pauline watched her go. Above, the sound continued. Theodore and Arthur, crying into the night, and the whole great house turning its face away from them. She went back inside. She did not go to bed. She finished the scullery. She repinned her hair. She brought the last of the evening's linens to the linen press. And then she sat on the narrow bench outside the linen room and listened. The sound was worse from the back staircase. It traveled down through some trick of the walls, arriving clearer and more insistent on the lower floors than in the corridor directly outside the nursery. Pauline pressed her back against the cool plaster and let herself hear it. They were not crying because they were wicked. She knew that. She had known children at St. Bridget's who cried for weeks after they arrived, not because something was wrong with them, but because they had been taken from everything familiar and placed inside a house that did not yet know how to love them back. It was not illness. It was grief in the only language infants possessed. A maid was not supposed to have thoughts like this. A maid was not supposed to have any thoughts about the Duke's sons at all. Pauline pressed her cold fingers together and told herself to go to bed. Then, from above, she heard the nursemaid's voice rise sharply, and then the sound of running feet, and then the upper nursery door swinging open. A moment later, the nursemaid, a young woman named Agnes, appeared at the top of the back staircase, her face pink and her cap half off. "Roberts!" Agnes saw Pauline below and grabbed the railing. "Mrs. Clark said to fetch fresh linen and warm cloths quickly. The older one has been sick on his sheets, and now both of them are screaming, and I cannot..." I cannot manage it, and Miss Shaw is already there, and it is. She stopped, breathed. Please, come up. Pauline was already on her feet. She collected the linen. She collected the warm cloths. She followed Agnes up the back staircase, through the upper corridor, and stopped outside the nursery door. The crying was so much louder here, not background anymore, not distant. It was immediate and raw, pressing against the door like something alive, and Pauline felt it go through her chest like a key. Finding a lock she had not known, was there. Agnes pushed the door open. Pauline stepped inside for the first time. The nursery was a beautiful room, in the distracted way that rooms are beautiful when no one has had time to care for the beauty in a long while. Carved cradles with ivory linen, painted plaster ceiling with soft clouds, a fireplace with a brass guard, silver rattles on a shelf, lace curtains that must have been white once, slightly yellowed now from the coal smoke that was never entirely absent from an English winter. And on the wall above the fireplace, a portrait. Pauline looked at it for only a moment. A woman in blue silk, seated, with dark eyes and a composed expression and a quality about her that suggested warmth beneath the composure. Adelaide, Duchess of Wintermere. Painted before the twins were born, clearly, because there was no heaviness in her face, only calm. She was watching the room with those dark eyes, and the room was not answering her well tonight. Theodore lay in his cradle, with his tiny fists twisted in the ruined linen, his face scarlet, his cries absolutely continuous. Arthur was worse in his own way, not louder, but more resolute, his chin set even in distress, with a determination that looked absurdly adult on a face so young. Miss Cordelia Shaw stood between the cradles with her arms clasped at her waist, her jaw set, her eyes moving between the two boys with an expression that wanted to be authority, but was becoming, despite itself, alarm. The second nursemaid, a woman called Nell, was attempting to warm milk at the small fire, her hands unsteady. Roberts, Cordelia saw her immediately. Set those linens there and step back to the wall. You are here to assist, not to interfere. Yes, Miss Shaw. Pauline set the linens on the side table. She stepped back. She watched. Cordelia tried Theodore first. She bent over the cradle with the expression of someone who had decided that calm was a matter of will, and attempted to adjust his position. Theodore's crying redoubled. His fist caught the edge of her sleeve and pulled, and Cordelia straightened and pressed her lips together. Nell brought the warm milk. Arthur turned his face away. Theodore would not be lifted. The room felt tight. The crying felt enormous. Agnes was near tears herself, hovering near the door with her arms wrapped around herself. Pauline stood against the wall and felt the sound in her ribs. She had told herself not to step forward. She was a scullery maid. She had been told to stay by the wall. She had no position, no authority, no right to cross the space between the wall and the Duke's sons. But she had also been a child in a long dark room at St. Bridget's, crying, and no one had come. She stepped forward. Roberts. Cordelia's voice was a blade. Forgive me, Miss Shaw. Pauline did not stop. She moved to Theodore's cradle and bent down until she was level with him. She did not pick him up yet. She only leaned close, and she hummed. She hummed the only song she knew from before. The one her mother had sung in the poorhouse before the sickness took her, when Pauline was small enough to believe that a song could fix anything. It was simple, four notes repeating. It had no name that Pauline knew of. It was just the song. Theodore's crying changed. It did not stop immediately. It stuttered first. A hitch, a catch, as though something in the sound had been interrupted. His fists uncurled slightly. His face, still red, turned toward the sound. Arthur's cries weakened. His head turned. Pauline kept humming. She raised her hand and laid it very gently alongside Theodore's face, her rough palm against his warm cheek, and she let the song travel from her chest into the cool air of the nursery. Theodore's crying stopped. The silence fell so completely that Nell actually gasped. Pauline kept humming. She moved to Arthur's cradle and did the same. Her hand, her voice, the four notes repeating. Arthur's lower lip trembled. His eyes, dark like his mother's in the portrait, fixed on Pauline's face with an attention that was startling in an infant. He stopped crying. The nursery was silent. Theodore reached out his hand, his tiny fingers spreading in the air, searching. Pauline gave him her finger. He wrapped his entire fist around it and held on with the grip of someone who intended to stay. Arthur turned his face into Pauline's palm and exhaled. The room did not breathe. Cordelia Shaw stood very still, with her arms still clasped at her waist, and if her expression was not one of open humiliation, it had at least been stripped of its certainty. Nell held the untouched milk. Agnes was frozen in the doorway. Then, from the doorway to the corridor, there was a sound. Pauline did not look up at first. She was still humming, quieter now, barely breath. But the quality of the silence shifted. It became aware of something, and Pauline slowly raised her eyes. Desmond Vaughan stood in the nursery doorway. He had not entered. He stood with one hand on the door frame, still in his coat, his face unreadable, in the way that faces are unreadable when too many things are happening in them at once. He had heard the silences, she realized. He had come because the silence was strange after so many months of sound. His eyes moved from the cradles to Pauline. She met his gaze for only a moment. Dark eyes heavy with something she did not have a name for, and then she lowered hers. A maid's instinct, trained deep. Her heart was beating hard, though she could not entirely account for why. The twins were quiet. Theodore still held her finger. Desmond looked at the room. He looked at his sons. He looked at the poor maid bent over the cradle, with her rough hand against his son's cheek. When he spoke, his voice was very low. It was not loud. It did not need to be. "What did you do to my sons?" Pauline opened her mouth. And Theodore began crying again the moment she lifted her hand. The sound resumed instantly, sharp and bereft, and the nursery snapped back from its brief peace like a bowstring released. Pauline pressed her hand back against Theodore's cheek without thinking. The crying eased, stopped. Theodore's fingers found hers again. The Duke was still in the doorway. She could feel his gaze on the back of her neck, the way you feel weather changing. Heavy and particular. She hummed the four notes again, softer, and Arthur settled back into sleep, with the trusting bonelessness of an infant who had decided a certain pair of hands was safe. "Miss Shaw," Desmond spoke without turning his head. "Would you explain to me what is happening in my nursery?" Cordelia gathered herself quickly. "Your Grace, the boys were distressed, as usual. I was managing the situation when Roberts took it upon herself to." "Was she managing it before or after?" Crying stopped. A pause. Brief and unpleasant. "She approached the cradles without permission, Your Grace. I had directed her to remain at the wall, and the crying stopped when she did not remain at the wall." Cordelia's voice tightened. "It appears so, for the moment. Whether it will last?" "It has not lasted in 14 months, Desmond said. "Let me consider that." He finally stepped into the nursery. Pauline heard his footsteps on the boards, slow, deliberate, and kept her eyes on the twins. She was afraid to look up, not because of his title, though she was acutely aware of that too, but because of something in his voice that she could not quite place. Not anger. Something older than anger. He stopped beside her. Close enough that she could see the edge of his dark coat in her peripheral vision. He looked at Theodore. Theodore was asleep now, his hand still loosely wrapped around Pauline's finger. His small chest rose and fell. Arthur slept beside him, his dark lashes resting against his flushed cheeks. Desmond looked at them for a long time, then he said, very quietly, "Where did you learn that song?" Pauline hesitated. "My mother sang it, Your Grace, at the parish poorhouse in Ashfield. It was simply the song she knew." Beside the fire, Nell had gone very still. Pauline did not see Mrs. Clark enter the room, but she heard her, the quiet footfall, the small intake of breath that was controlled almost before it began. Something passed across the housekeeper's face that Pauline did not catch because she was still looking at the cradles. Desmond said nothing for a long moment, then he looked at Pauline directly, and she had no choice but to meet his eyes. Up close, he was harder to read than she had expected. She had seen him from a distance before, passing through the hall, dismounting in the courtyard, standing at the library window on the evenings when the light caught him sideways. He had always looked cold from a distance. Up close, he looked something more complicated. His eyes were dark brown, nearly black in the candlelight, and they held the same quality she had seen in the faces of people who had been living with something painful. For so long, they had forgotten what they looked like without it. "Your name?" he said. "Pauline Roberts, Your Grace, scullery maid. How long have you been in this house, Roberts?"
"3 years, Your Grace."
He glanced at Mrs. Clark, who had materialized near the door with her usual gift for being present without announcement. The housekeeper gave a single small nod. "Confirmed." Desmond looked back at Pauline, then at the sleeping twins. He said nothing more. He turned and walked back toward the door, and Pauline allowed herself to breathe. At the threshold, he paused. "She is to come to the nursery tomorrow evening." He said this to Mrs. Clark, not to Pauline, "if this holds."
"Yes, Your Grace." He left.
Cordelia Shaw remained standing between the cradles, with the expression of someone who has just watched a fire go out, and is still holding the bucket. Then she turned to Pauline, and her voice, when it came, was controlled but cold in the way that cold things can burn. "You will not read too much into this, Roberts." Pauline said nothing. "You calmed them once. It may not happen again, and you would do well to remember that your position here does not change because of one fortunate evening." "I understand, Miss Shaw." Cordelia looked at her for a moment, then at the twins. Then she turned and walked out, and Pauline was left alone in the nursery with Agnes and Nell, and the soft sleeping sounds of two small boys, and the portrait of a woman in blue on the wall above the fire. She looked at the portrait. Adelaide Vaughan had her son's dark eyes. Pauline had not noticed that before, or rather, she had not had occasion to look. Now she saw it clearly. Theodore had his mother's brow. Arthur had her chin, that firm, decided quality. They were hers. Even in this nursery that had forgotten how to be warm, they carried her. Pauline touched Theodore's hand one more time, very gently, before she straightened. "Sleep," she said too softly for anyone but the infants to hear. "I'm here." She did not know then what that promise would cost her. She only knew she meant it. The days that followed moved differently, not quickly. Nothing moved quickly at Wintermere House, which was a house built to resist, change the way old stone resists water, slowly, stubbornly, wearing down only over years, but differently. Pauline was sent to the nursery each evening, officially to bring linens and assist Agnes with the end-of-day preparations. Unofficially, everyone understood what she was there for. The twins knew. They heard her footstep on the third stair from the top, which had a particular creak, and they quieted before she entered. They turned their heads toward the door. When she came in, Theodore reached for her immediately, his arms lifting even before she had crossed to the cradles, with the full and absolute trust of someone who has never learned to doubt what they want. Arthur was slightly more watchful. He studied her face each time, those dark eyes steady and serious, as though conducting a small private assessment. Then, when he had finished assessing, he would reach for her sleeve and hold on. Mrs. Clark watched all of this and kept her own counsel. Cordelia Shaw watched all of this and simmered. The Dowager Duchess Eleanor Vaughan watched from the doorway one afternoon, uninvited by anyone, standing in the corridor with the posture of a woman who views everything slightly below her own eyeline. She was tall, the Dowager, with silver hair dressed high and eyes that were Desmond's, but without whatever grief had softened them in her son. Hers were simply cold. She looked at Pauline with the twins. She looked for a long time. She said nothing that day. But 3 days later, she found Desmond in his library. Desmond was at his desk when his mother entered, but he was not working. He was sitting with one of Adelaide's gloves in his hand. A pale kid glove, small, impossibly small for a grown woman's hand, turning it over and over in his fingers. He had not moved it from the small rosewood box beside the inkstand. He had not been able to. Eleanor closed the door behind her with the deliberate quiet of someone who wants you to know how controlled they are. "You are aware," she said, "that the servants are talking. The servants are always talking. About the maid, the parish girl." Eleanor settled into the chair across from the desk, as though the chair had been placed there for her personal use, which, in her view, it probably had been. It is one thing for the boys to be managed by a capable nurse. It is another for them to become attached to a girl who came from a poorhouse and has no more business in a nursery than she does in a drawing room. Desmond set the glove down. The boys sleep. The boys should not require a scullery maid to sleep, and yet they do. He folded his hands on the desk. "Would you prefer they go back to not sleeping, Mother? I would prefer they develop the constitution proper to boys of their station." Eleanor's voice was even. Attachment to servants is a habit that serves no one. It makes the children soft, and it makes the servants presumptuous. Miss Shaw is a trained governess. She is educated, qualified, and appropriate. If there is a management problem in the nursery, it is her responsibility to resolve it. Miss Shaw has been resolving it for 8 months without success. Then perhaps Miss Shaw requires better direction. "Perhaps," Desmond said, in the tone he used when he did not intend to do anything the sentence implied. He picked up a letter from the desk. "Was there something else, Mother?" Eleanor looked at him for a long moment. The look was the one she had used since he was a boy, patient and dissatisfied. The look of someone waiting for a more satisfactory version of you to arrive. "You are watching her," Eleanor said. Desmond did not respond. "I know what that looks like in a man, Desmond. You are imagining things I am not." She stood. "I am warning you. She is a poor maid with nothing to recommend her, and everything to gain from your attention. Whatever you think you see in her, what the household sees is a duke whose judgment has been compromised by 14 months of grief." She smoothed her skirts. "Do not give them reason to say so." She left. Desmond sat in the quiet library for a long time after the door closed. He was not thinking about the letter. He was thinking against his will, and with a vague irritation at himself for doing so, about a pair of pale gray eyes bent over a cradle. About a voice so quiet it was almost not a voice. Barely more than breath and 4 simple notes. His son slept for that voice. He found himself wanting to understand why. He told himself it was only curiosity, administrative interest. A man who runs an estate must understand the workings of his own household. That was all. He went back to his letter. He did not convince himself. 3 weeks passed, and then 4, and the rhythm of the nursery changed completely. It was not dramatic. It did not announce itself. It settled into the house the way warmth settles into a cold room. So gradually that you are halfway comfortable before you realize the chill has left. Pauline came to the nursery each evening, and then each afternoon, and then, when Agnes fell ill with a winter cold, each morning too. Nobody formally extended her appointment. It simply expanded, the way water fills the shape of whatever contains it. The twins grew. They were 5 months old now, and beginning to do the things that infants do when they are fed and rested and held enough, which is to say, they were beginning to become themselves. Theodore had opinions about everything, and communicated them with great energy, and not a single word. He could not yet sit up, but he tried, perpetually, with an expression of ferocious concentration that Pauline found difficult not to laugh at. Arthur was quieter, watchful, content to study the ceiling, or Pauline's face with equal intensity, as though cataloguing details for later use. They both laughed now. The first time Theodore laughed, a full, sudden, delighted sound, entirely unprepared for by anyone, least of all Theodore himself. Pauline had been making a ridiculous face while folding a cloth, and the sound of it had startled her so completely that she had stopped and stared at him for a moment before laughing herself. Agnes had come running from the adjoining room, convinced something was wrong, and found both the maid and the infant in a state of helpless amusement. Agnes had told Mrs. Clark. Mrs. Clark had told no one, but she had been seen smiling into her mending that evening. Cordelia Shaw had heard the story secondhand and had not smiled. She came to the nursery more often now, which had the quality of surveillance rather than attention. She stood near the window while Pauline sat with the boys, her eyes moving between them with the look of someone cataloguing evidence. She corrected Pauline over minor things, the angle of a blanket, the temperature of the bath water, the timing of a feeding. Each correction was delivered with just enough authority to remind everyone present of the hierarchy. Pauline accepted each one without argument. This Cordelia found more frustrating than pushback would have been. An argument could be won. Quiet dignity simply sat there and continued being itself. One afternoon, Cordelia waited until Agnes had taken the boys to the adjoining room, and then turned to Pauline, who was refolding the day's linens. "You are not their mother," Cordelia said. Pauline did not look up from the linen. "No, Miss Shaw. You are not their nurse, their governess, or any relation to them whatsoever. You are a scullery maid performing a temporary function that has, through a series of coincidences, been allowed to continue beyond its appropriate scope." "Yes, Miss Shaw. Do not mistake the boy's attachment for your own elevation. Children attach to whatever is present. If you were replaced tomorrow, they would attach to whoever replaced you within a fortnight." Pauline smoothed the last fold of the linen and straightened. She met Cordelia's eyes. "I know my place, Miss Shaw," she said, and then, very quietly, so quietly that it was not quite a challenge, but was not quite a capitulation either, "I also know theirs." She gathered the linens and walked out. In the corridor, her heart was beating fast, and her hands were steady, and she was surprised to discover that she felt no regret at all. Desmond came to the nursery late on a Thursday evening. He came, ostensibly, to see the boys. He told himself this. He had been meaning to come for several days, which was something that he had also told himself several days running, and each time something had intervened. Estate business, correspondence, the solicitor from London, the particular and terrible wait of afternoons when the light in the library turned gold and reminded him of things he had no use for remembering. The nursery was quiet when he arrived, which was still remarkable enough that he paused before opening the door. Inside, firelight. Agnes asleep in the chair by the window, her head resting against the wall, with the complete abandon of someone who had not slept properly in weeks. Pauline seated in the low chair beside the cradles, Theodore against her shoulder with his small fist pressed to her collarbone, Arthur beside her in the crook of her arm, one of his tiny hands wrapped around her thumb. She was reading, not aloud. There was a book open on her knee, positioned carefully so that turning pages would not disturb either child, and she was reading with the concentrated quiet of someone who does not get much time alone with words, and intends to use it fully. Desmond stood in the doorway and did not announce himself. He told himself he was deciding whether to enter. He told himself this for longer than was entirely honest. Pauline looked up without moving anything except her eyes. She saw him in the doorway and was still for a moment. That stillness that was not fear but something more cautious, the stillness of someone recalibrating. Then she made to rise, which would have disturbed both boys. "Don't." The word came from him quickly and quietly. She settled back, waited. Desmond entered. He moved to the opposite side of the cradles and looked at his sons. Theodore's eyes were closed. Arthur's were open, tracking Desmond with that serious, level gaze that Desmond could never quite decide what to do with. "He watches everyone like that," Pauline said softly. "He always has. Agnes thinks he finds people interesting." Desmond looked at Arthur. Arthur looked back at Desmond with the focused attention of someone who had not yet decided what category of person this was. "Does he?" Desmond said. "He'll reach for you if you give him your hand." A pause. Then Desmond extended his hand slowly toward Arthur. Arthur studied the hand with his usual deliberation. Then he reached out and wrapped his fingers around Desmond's, and Desmond's chest did something that he was not going to examine closely tonight. "He held Adelaide's hand like this," Desmond said, and did not appear to have intended to say it. Pauline was very quiet. She had 3 days before she... He stopped, started again. She held them. She knew their faces. She knew them. He turned his hand slightly, and Arthur's grip adjusted. "I sometimes think I did not deserve more time with them than she had." Pauline let the silence sit for a moment. Then she said, with great care, "They are hers, Your Grace. In every way that matters, they carry her with them. That does not diminish with time." He looked at her. It was a different look from any he had given her before. Not assessment. Not the guarded suspicion of the first night, or the reluctant acknowledgement of the evening since. This was something more undefended. The look of a man who has said a thing he has not said in 14 months, and finds the air on the other side of it unexpectedly breathable. "How old are you, Roberts?" he asked.
19, Your Grace.
"And where did you learn to be wise?"
She laughed, quietly, quickly, genuinely. It surprised her as much as it surprised him.
"I learned to watch and listen, Your Grace. At St. Bridget's, that was the safest thing to do. You learn a great deal from watching." He studied her face. The firelight was in her grey eyes, which were not, he noticed, with a small shock of attention that he immediately tucked away, simply grey. They were the color of morning fog over water, changing slightly as the fire moved. "You may stay until they sleep," he said, which was not what he had meant to say. He had meant to say something practical about scheduling. He cleared his throat. "I'll inform Mrs. Clark that your duties are being formally adjusted."
"Thank you, Your Grace."
He nodded once. He turned to go. He paused. "The song," he said, without turning back. "Sing it again." It was not a request, exactly. But it was not quite an order either. Pauline began to hum. Desmond stood at the nursery door for a long moment, his back to the room, his hand on the doorframe. The four notes traveled through the warm air. Theodore stirred and settled. Arthur's grip on Desmond's finger had released when he stepped back, and Desmond's hand was still loosely open, as though he had not fully registered the absence yet. He left without speaking again, but he stood outside the door for an additional minute that he would not have been able to account for. The humming continued within, and Wintermere House, for the first time in a long time, sounded like something other than a house in mourning. Cordelia found the Dowager Duchess in the Rose sitting room the following afternoon. Eleanor was at her correspondence, as she was most afternoons, conducting the business of her social world with the organized precision she brought to everything. She did not look up when Cordelia entered, but the quality of her attention shifted to indicate that she was listening.
"There is a matter I feel I have a duty to bring to your attention," Cordelia said.
Eleanor set down her pen. Cordelia told her what she had observed. She was precise and edited. She was too skilled to overstate. She spoke of the Duke's visits to the nursery, which had always been rare, and which were now occurring twice weekly. She spoke of the length of those visits, which had grown. She spoke of the way he looked at Roberts, which she described only as particular. She did not editorialize. She did not need to. Eleanor listened with her hands folded and her face composed and her eyes entirely still.
"I see," she said when Cordelia finished. "I thought it best that you know.
You thought correctly. Eleanor picked up her pen again, which was a signal and a dismissal both. Thank you, Miss Shaw. Continue your duties. Cordelia left. Eleanor sat alone for a moment with her pen in her hand and her eyes on the middle distance. Then she began to write a letter to Mr. Edmund Faulkner. The evening came without ceremony, as most moments of rupture do. Desmond entered the nursery at 9:30 on a cold December Tuesday, earlier than usual, and found the room in the particular peace that had become its new condition under Pauline's care. The fire was well kept. The air smelled of warm milk, and the lavender sachets Agnes had begun replacing weekly. The cradles were quiet. Pauline was asleep. She was in the low chair beside the fireplace. She had not planned to sleep. This was evident from the position, slightly forward, her head resting against her folded arm on the chair, back in the way of someone who sat down briefly and was taken without warning. The book from last week was on the floor, beside her, face down. Theodore was pressed against her left side with his head on her arm, both small fists curled against his chest. Arthur was against her right, his face turned into her shoulder, one hand gripping the front of her dress with the determined grip of someone who has decided exactly where they intend to stay. The twins were not just asleep. They were absolutely at rest in the way that infants rest when they feel entirely safe. Boneless, trusting, complete, Desmond stood at the door. He should have entered. He should have coughed, announced himself, given Pauline the opportunity to rise and step back, and resume the proper positions of employer and employed. He knew this. He stood there anyway. The firelight moved across her face. Her cap had come slightly loose, and a strand of her brown hair had fallen against her cheek. Her hands, those rough, reddened hands that told the whole story of what her life had been before this room, were curved gently around his son's. Something moved in his chest that was not grief. He did not know what to do with that. He stepped into the room, crossed to the cradles, and reached down toward Arthur. Arthur stirred immediately, his face scrunching, his lips beginning the preparatory movement that preceded crying. His grip tightened on Pauline's dress. Pauline's eyes opened. She oriented herself quickly. Location, company, the Duke's presence, and made to rise. Your Grace, I apologize, I didn't. Let me. Stay still. He was still reaching for Arthur. Arthur's face crumpled entirely. He sleeps better if he's not moved until he's ready, Pauline said, carefully, softly, watching Desmond's hands. If you take him quickly, he startles. But if you... Here, Your Grace, if you slide your hand beneath him first, slowly, and let him feel the warmth of your hand before you lift. Desmond stiffened. A maid was instructing him in how to hold his son. The thought arrived with a sharp edge of humiliation that he recognized, even as he felt it, as disproportionate. It was not the instruction that stung. It was the need for it. The fact that his own son's nurse, a parish girl who had been in his house for 3 years without his noticing, knew his child better than he did. He straightened without lifting Arthur. Arthur fussed, and then, sensing the shift, quieted. Theodore slept on. Pauline looked up at Desmond with those clear grey eyes, and he read in them no triumph, no satisfaction, only care, directed at the twins, spilling incidentally toward him, as a person who was also in the room. That was somehow worse. He wanted her to be pleased with herself, so that he could dismiss it. You should not be sleeping in here, he said. His voice came out harder than he intended. I know, Your Grace. I did not plan. A maid's bed is below stairs, Roberts. Not in my son's nursery. Yes, Your Grace. She moved to lift Theodore from her side carefully and lay him in his cradle. He fussed once and was still. She rose, smoothing her dress, re-pinning her cap with steady hands. She was composed in the face of his tone in the way that women are composed when they have a great deal of practice absorbing things without showing that they have felt them. Their attachment to you has grown beyond what is appropriate, Desmond said. She said nothing. It is not good for them. When they are older, when they understand the world and their place in it, an attachment formed with a maid in childhood will cause them confusion. It is not your fault. It is mine, for allowing it to continue longer than was wise. He heard the words as he said them, and they were true, in a certain way, and also not the whole truth, which was that his sons were happy, and he did not want to look at what Pauline had given them, because it implicated him in the question of why he had not given it himself. As you say, Your Grace, you will finish the week's duties and then return to your regular assignment below stairs. Mrs. Clark will make the adjustment. Pauline looked at him, one long, level look that held no anger and no pleading, only a clarity that he found difficult to meet. The boys are very small, she said quietly, and this house has been cold a long time. He said nothing. Yes, Your Grace. She retrieved her book from the floor, folded it under her arm, and walked to the door. She paused there. Good night, Your Grace. She left. From the cradles, Theodore stirred. His hands began to move, searching, patting the empty space beside him where she had been. His face pulled together. A sound began in his chest. Arthur was already crying. Desmond stood in the middle of the nursery and listened to his son's cry for the woman he had just sent away. The next 3 days were the longest the house had known since the first weeks. Theodore and Arthur cried from dusk until past midnight, resumed before dawn, and slept only in short, exhausted intervals that gave no one any real rest. Agnes developed shadows under her eyes. Nell gave notice on the second day, which no one blamed her for. Cordelia Shaw stood between the cradles with her jaw set and her color high and attempted every method in her considerable arsenal, and accomplished nothing except to make the boys cry differently. From distress, which was grief in a minor key, to bewilderment, which was grief at full register. Desmond sat in his library at midnight on the second night and could not read. He could hear them even here. The walls of Wintermere House were very thick, built to contain and insulate, but they were not thick enough for this. The crying travelled through the stone the way grief travels through a family. Not loudly, but persistently, and impossible to lock away. He tried the lullaby. He stood in the corridor outside the closed nursery door and hummed the four notes, very quietly, because he had heard them enough by now that he knew them. His voice was nothing like hers. It was deeper and rougher, and it had not been asked to do this kind of work before. But Theodore, who must have heard some quality of the melody through the door, quieted for 30 seconds. 30 seconds, then resumed. Desmond pressed his hand flat against the door. He thought about what Pauline had said. The house had been cold a long time. He had told himself it was grief. That grief explained everything. The distance, the closed rooms, the inability to go in when his sons were crying and simply hold them. Grief was real. He was not performing it. But grief could also be. He admitted this in the corridor, in the dark, with no one to observe the admission. A language in which he had been saying things he had not fully intended to say. He had been telling his sons, with 14 months of absence, that he did not know how to love them without Adelaide here to show him how. They had heard him, and then Pauline had come, and she had brought something to the nurse had uttered that had nothing to do with skill, and nothing to do with magic, and everything to do with the one thing Desmond had not been able to offer, presence. He went back to the library. He sat at his desk. He tried for a long time to be the kind of man who could be wrong and not act on it. He was not that kind of man. He was at the nursery door by midnight. Pauline was already there. She had come up the back staircase, which she was no longer supposed to use for this purpose. In her nightgown with a shawl pulled over it, her hair loose and dark against her shoulders, carrying nothing except herself, and the quiet that always seemed to arrive with her. She stopped when she saw him. He stopped when he saw her. For one very still moment, they looked at each other in the dark corridor outside the nursery door. Then she said, simply,
I could hear them from my room, he said. So could I.
Theodore cried behind the door. Arthur's voice joined his. Pauline stepped forward. He did not stop her. She went into the nursery. He stood in the corridor for a long moment, listening to the crying change and soften, and then, slowly, impossibly, stop. Behind her voice, the four notes. In front of the door, the Duke of Wintermere, standing in the dark, who had made a mistake and knew it, and was not yet ready to say so aloud. But almost, almost. I gave you an order. His voice was controlled. Controlled in the way that things are controlled, when the thing beneath them is very large, and has not been looked at directly. Pauline turned from the cradles. Desmond stood in the doorway. He was fully dressed, as though he had known he would be coming here, and had prepared himself for it. His eyes went to the cradles, both boys quiet, Theodore with his eyes already closing, Arthur watching the room with his customary patience, and then to Pauline. She lifted her chin. She did not drop her eyes. They were crying, she said. The whole house could hear them. I am aware of what the house could hear. I gave you an order, Roberts. You did, Your Grace, and I am sorry to have disobeyed it. She was not performing the apology. She meant it. She also meant what came next. But I cannot hear children cry when I know what stops it. I cannot do that. His jaw was tight. You do not decide what you can and cannot do in my house. No, Your Grace. You are a maid. You are employed to perform specific functions, none of which include determining when my sons require your presence. I know, Your Grace. Then why? Because they are small, she said, and they were frightened, and the house is very quiet tonight. And sometimes small frightened things need someone to come. The words fell into the room. Theodore's breathing deepened. Arthur turned his face toward Pauline and then closed his eyes. Desmond stood in the doorway with all of his authority and the full weight of his title, and the controlled surface of a man who had decided how this conversation was going to go, and he could not find the ground. He heard footsteps in the corridor. More than one person. The Dowager Duchess appeared first. Then, behind her, Cordelia Shaw, fully dressed and alert in the way of someone who had not been to bed. Eleanor looked at Pauline, at the cradles, at Desmond. Her voice was even and final. She disobeyed your direct order, Desmond. Whatever else may have prompted it, that is the fact. Cordelia stepped forward. Your Grace, I must speak plainly. Roberts has been encouraging the boy's dependence on her deliberately. Her behavior tonight is not an isolated incident of concern. It is part of a pattern. Pauline looked at Cordelia. I have not encouraged anything that was not already there. You exceed your station consistently and deliberately, Cordelia said, her voice steady and lethal. You have used two vulnerable children to establish yourself in this household, in a position you would never otherwise have reached. That is not care. That is calculation. The accusation was so utterly unlike the truth that Pauline felt it as a physical thing. A cold shock, followed by a spreading heat of anger that she had to press down hard before it showed on her face. Miss Shaw, she said, I know you believe that. I know what I have observed. Desmond was watching Pauline. His expression was complicated in a way she could not fully read. She looked for the man who had stood outside the nursery door and hummed four notes, and she found him buried somewhere beneath the Duke, and she did not know how to reach him. Your Grace, she said, I ask only that you trust what you have seen. He was quiet. That was the moment. She saw it. The hesitation, the pull between what he felt and what propriety and grief and his mother's cold certainty were telling him to say. The hesitation was brief. For anyone else in the room, it might have been invisible. But Pauline was watching very carefully. She saw him hesitate. She saw him choose. You will report to Mrs. Clark in the morning, he said. Your assignment in this house will be reviewed. Pauline said nothing. Eleanor nodded once, satisfied. Cordelia's face settled into something that was not quite a smile, but was its intention. Pauline looked at the twins one last time. Theodore sleeping. Arthur watching. Then she crossed the room, past Cordelia, past Eleanor, past Desmond, and walked out. 3 days later, Adelaide's brooch disappeared from the Duchess's jewel cabinet and was found among the things in Pauline's small attic room. The brooch was a small oval piece, pale enamel, gold setting, the clasp broken at one side in a way Adelaide herself had damaged and never had repaired. It had been in the jewel cabinet in the closed room at the end of the east corridor, the room nobody went into. Somebody had gone into it. Faulkner, the estate steward. A thin, precise man who shared the dowager's view that order was its own morality, brought the brooch to Desmond in the library. He set it on the desk with the careful gravity of someone who has been waiting for this moment, and wants it acknowledged. This was found in Roberts's belongings, Your Grace. Desmond looked at the brooch, the pale enamel, the broken clasp. He knew this piece. He had been in the room where it was kept, twice, in 14 months, standing at the threshold, because he could not go further. He knew the cabinet. He knew its contents the way you know the contents of a room you cannot bear to sort through. He picked it up. Who found it? Agnes, Your Grace, in the process of collecting the attic linens. Desmond held the brooch. He turned it over. The broken clasp turned in his fingers. He thought of Pauline in the nursery. Her voice, her rough hands against his son's face, her grey eyes in the firelight, reading. He thought of the things Cordelia had said. He thought of his mother. He thought of the hesitation he had allowed himself 3 days ago, and what it had told her. Send for Roberts, he said. Pauline came to the library. She came without hurry and without visible fear, wearing the expression she wore when she had been called for discipline before. Not resignation, exactly, more like stillness. She looked at the desk. She saw the brooch. Something crossed her face that was too quick and too genuine to be performed. I did not take it, she said. It was found among your things. I know, Your Grace. She was looking at the brooch, not at him. I know how that must appear. You have handled the late Duchess's belongings before, in the normal course. No, Your Grace. She looked up. Her eyes were clear and very steady. I have never entered the East Corridor rooms. I was told they were private. I respected that. He looked at her. She looked back. He wanted to believe her. He could feel that wanting the way you feel weather. Not as thought, but as a physical change in the atmosphere around him. He wanted to take her word. He wanted to dismiss the brooch and tell Faulkner to look elsewhere and watch Pauline's face ease from that terrible stillness. He did not do any of those things. He set the brooch back on the desk. This house, he said carefully, cannot harbor doubt of this kind, not about the Duchess's things. Pauline was quiet for a long moment. Then she said in a voice very low and very even, I have been poor all my life, Your Grace, but I have never stolen what grief made sacred. The sentence landed in the room like a stone into still water and spread outward, and he felt every ring. He said nothing. She waited. He still said nothing. Pauline drew a slow breath. Her composure did not crack. It simply settled into something more final. The look of a person who has received their answer even from silence. Shall I collect my things tonight, Your Grace? His silence was his answer. She nodded once, the way you nod when you are telling yourself that you expected this, that you prepared for this, that disappointment is familiar and does not have to be shown. She turned and walked out. She did not cry, not until she was outside. Before dawn, Pauline Roberts left Wintermere House through the servant's entrance. She had one bundle, a cloth tied around everything she owned, which was not much, her two dresses, her boots, the wooden comb. A single book Mrs. Clark had pressed into her hands without comment, with the face of someone doing a thing they know is insufficient and doing it anyway. Don't go to the village, Mrs. Clark had said very quietly in the dark passage. There's a dour cottage on the east edge of the estate grounds. It's been empty 2 seasons. Nobody will look there. Pauline had nodded. She had not been able to speak just then. She stepped out into the rain. It was heavy and cold, the kind of rain that has no direction, that simply falls from all sides at once. The gravel of the service courtyard was dark and slick. The kitchen garden was invisible in the dark. The lantern above the servant's door cast a circle of yellow light that reached approximately 3 steps before giving up. From above, through the stone walls of Wintermere House, she heard it, faint, distant, but unmistakable. Theodore and Arthur were crying. She stood in the rain for a moment and let herself hear it. She let it hurt. She had learned at St. Bridget's that trying not to feel things does not make them smaller. It only makes you carry them in the wrong way, bent sideways under a weight that was always going to be there regardless. So she felt it. She felt the boys' voices, and she felt the cold, and she felt the particular quality of what it was to be dismissed from the only place that had felt, briefly, like something she belonged to. Then she tied her bundle tighter and walked into the rain. Behind her, the light above the servant's door went out, and inside Wintermere House, in the library on the east side, a candle was still burning. Desmond sat at his desk with the broken brooch in his hand. He was not reading. He was not working. He was looking at the clasp. The clasp was broken on the inside curve in the specific way of a mechanism that had been forced. Not dropped, not worn. Forced. And Adelaide had always opened the cabinet with the small brass key that hung on the ring with the others. But the ring was kept in a locked drawer, and only Desmond and the estate steward had access to that drawer. He looked at the brooch. He turned it over. He thought about Faulkner's face when he had placed it on the desk. The careful gravity, the precision, the small, controlled satisfaction of a man who had done something he intended to do. He thought about Cordelia, about the dowager, about the convenient timing. He thought about pale gray eyes and the sentence that was still sitting in the room, like something he had not finished hearing. I have never stolen what grief made sacred. He set the brooch down very slowly. From upstairs, his sons were crying. For the first time, Desmond heard them not as noise, and not as accusation directed at him, but as something more specific. They were not crying because they were difficult. They were not crying because they were spoiled, or haunted, or born under sorrow. They were crying because the warmth had left the house again, and he had let it go. He rose from his desk. He went to the door of his library, then stopped, turned back, picked up his coat and his riding gloves. He walked out of the library. He walked past the stable boy, who was asleep on his feet, and kicked the mounting block himself. He saddled his own horse. He rode out into the rain before dawn. He found her near the ruined chapel. The chapel stood at the eastern edge of the estate, past the formal gardens and the ha-ha, and the long stretch of elm trees that lined the old road. It had been decommissioned before Desmond was born, its glass long gone, its roof open to the weather, the stone walls standing out of habit. It was the kind of ruin that looks intentional until you get close, and then it just looks abandoned. Pauline was sheltering under what remained of the south wall, seated on a low stone, with her bundle in her lap, and her shawl pulled so tight around her that the rain had plastered it to her shoulders. She was soaked. Her hair was loose, dark, and heavy with water, and she had not heard his horse above the sound of the storm until he was already close. She looked up. She did not move. She did not rise. She looked at him in the rain with the face of someone who has decided they will not reach for anything they have not been clearly offered. He dismounted. He came toward her. He did not say anything for a moment. He was looking at her, taking in the bundle, the rain, the ruined wall, the fact of her sitting there in the dark cold, like someone who has accepted being rained upon, because there is simply nothing else to do. He took off his coat. He crossed to her and placed it around her shoulders, carefully, with both hands, his fingers working to settle it over the wet shawl without pulling. His hands paused for only a breath, at her shoulders, at the place where the cloth met the back of her neck, and then withdrew, deliberately. He stepped back. She was looking at his coat around her shoulders with an expression he could not quite name. "I was wrong," he said. The rain fell between them. "I was wrong to dismiss you. I was wrong to hesitate when you told me the truth. I was wrong about the brooch." He paused. "It was Cordelia. Faulkner helped her. I should have seen it sooner, and I did not, and you walked out of my house in the rain before dawn because I..." He stopped, steadied. "I was wrong." Pauline looked at him. She was still and dripping, and her eyes were very clear. "I am asking you to come back," he said, "as a scullery maid, as whatever you choose." She looked away, toward the open arch where the chapel door had been. The rain moved through it steadily. "Your Grace," she said, "I cannot come back to be needed, and then dismissed the moment it becomes uncomfortable. I am not. I am not a tool for the nursery, I am a person. I know that. You did not know it 3 days ago." "No," he said, "I did not." He was quiet for a moment. There was rain on his face and on his shoulders, and he was getting thoroughly cold, and he had not noticed either thing. "Yet I have been living inside grief for so long that I forgot how it distorts things. I told myself it was propriety and order and what was best for the boys. I was wrong. It was fear." He looked at her. "You were not afraid of the boys. You were not afraid of what they needed." "I was, and I punished you for showing me that." Pauline said nothing. "My sons are inconsolable," he said. "Arthur has not slept." Theodore cried until Agnes could not bear to stay in the room. He paused. "I tried the lullaby." Something shifted in Pauline's expression. "My voice is wrong for it," he said, with a helplessness that was clearly not something he had much practice with. But Theodore was quiet for 30 seconds. He looked at the ground. 30 seconds. Pauline was quiet for a long moment. The rain moved across the ruined chapel, and the elm trees shifted overhead, and somewhere in the dark a horse stamped, and the estate road glistened wet and black. "You said whatever I choose," she said finally. "Yes. Then I choose not to go back through the servants' entrance." He looked at her. "If I am coming back," she said, "I am coming back properly, with my character intact, with the matter of the brooch made known. I will not creep back through the side passage as though the last 3 days were my fault." He held her gaze. "You will come back through the front," he said. "It was not a question." "Yes, very well." She stood. She kept his coat around her shoulders. He did not ask for it back, and she did not offer it, and the choice of that, the coat remaining where he had placed it, was the smallest thing, and also not small at all. He offered his hand to assist her over the wet stone. She took it. His hand was warm despite the cold, and her hand was cold and rough, and he did not release it for a step longer than strictly necessary, and neither of them mentioned it. They rode back in the rain, she behind him on the horse, her arms around his waist for balance, the coat still around her, and the distance between them, containing everything that had not yet been said, and everything that was slowly, carefully, beginning to be felt. Wintermere House was waking when they arrived. The early servants were moving through the lower floors, and the kitchen fires were being lit, and the cold November light was beginning to press against the east windows, with its grey and reluctant quality. Desmond rode around to the front. He brought the horse to the front steps. He dismounted and reached up to help Pauline down. She stood on the front steps of Wintermere House in his coat, her hair loose and wet, her bundle under her arm, and she looked up at the facade with those steady grey eyes, and she looked very small against the stone, and not small at all in herself. The front door opened. Mrs. Clark stood in it, and behind her the footman, and further back, the accumulated surprised faces of the household morning staff. Desmond guided Pauline past all of them. "Roberts is under my personal protection," he said, "to the room, to the house, To anyone who intended to have an opinion about it, the matter of the brooch will be fully resolved today. A certain true servant who treats her with less than the respect owed a member of this household will answer to me directly. The hall was very quiet. Mrs. Clark looked at Pauline with an expression that was not quite relief and not quite I told you. Soane was probably both. Welcome back, she said. Cordelia Shaw appeared at the top of the main staircase. She looked down at the scene below. The Duke at the front entrance, Pauline in his coat, the still and watching household. And her face went through several things in quick succession before settling on something that was trying to be calm, but had the grain of fear running through it. She said,
Miss Shaw.
Desmond looked at her from the hall. I will see you in the library at 9 o'clock. Faulkner as well. Cordelia's hand tightened on the banister. Of course, Your Grace. From above, through the ceiling, the familiar sound began to change. Theodore's cry, then Arthur's, but different, higher, more urgent, recognizing something, the footstep on the stair, the coat, the particular quality of the air when she was in the house. Pauline looked up toward the ceiling. Then she looked at Desmond. He gave a very small nod. She handed Mrs. Clark the bundle. She walked up the main staircase, not the servant's staircase, the main one, the one with the carved rail and the portraits, and she walked down the corridor to the nurseries. She opened the door. The twins stopped crying before she reached the cradles. Theodore had his arms out. Arthur's eyes were open and fixed on her face, with an intensity that could only be described as recognition and relief. She lifted Theodore. She bent to Arthur. She hummed the four notes. From the doorway, Desmond watched, and for the first time since his sons were born, he did not feel like a man standing outside a room he did not deserve to enter. He felt, very faintly, the first breath of something like being invited in. The library confrontation was brief and final. Faulkner broke first. He was, at core, a practical man, and when Desmond laid out the sequence of events, the locked drawer, the key access, the broken clasp, the timing of the discovery relative to Cordelia's visit to the Dowager, Faulkner's practical nature assessed the options and arrived, quickly, at the one that required the least personal courage. He said Cordelia had asked him to retrieve the key. He said he had not known, precisely, what it would be used for. He said, this in the careful voice of a man who knew the difference between a lie and a carefully shaped truth, and who had decided the carefully shaped truth was his best position. Desmond looked at him for a long moment. Then he looked at Cordelia. Cordelia had not broken. She stood with her hands folded and her chin up, and the expression of a woman who has decided that if she is going down, she will do it with her posture intact. I acted in the best interests of this household, she said. You stole from the Duchess's cabinet, Desmond said. You placed the brooch among an innocent woman's belongings, and you allowed her to be dismissed from this house in the rain before dawn, knowing that she had done nothing. His voice was entirely level. This, Pauline would have recognized, was the most dangerous version of his anger, the version that did not raise itself. You will leave Wintermere House today. You will take a written reference covering the quality of your instructional work. Because whatever else you did here, the twins received appropriate early education in the weeks you were functional. I will not take that from you. But the rest, he stopped. You will say nothing of this house, or its inhabitants, to anyone. Cordelia looked at him for one more moment. Then she looked at the door, and at the floor, and whatever she was feeling moved through her face in a series of expressions she was too trained to fully show. Then she nodded, once, and walked out. Faulkner was given a different kind of reference and asked to be gone by Thursday. The public moment came that same afternoon. The household had gathered, as households do after a morning like that one, in the kind of loose cluster that forms around significant events. Servants finding reasons to be in adjoining rooms, proximity to information being its own reward. Desmond came out of the library with Pauline beside him, and the cluster resolved into a line of faces with varying degrees of guilt on them. He stood in the hall and looked at them all. He said, "Roberts was falsely accused. She was dismissed from this house without cause. She is returned under my protection, and you will conduct yourselves accordingly. If there is anyone present who finds that unclear, I invite them to seek a position elsewhere." Nobody moved. Nobody said anything. At the back of the hall, near the kitchen passage, the footman Terence, who had over 3 years made 7 separate remarks about parish girls, looked at the floor and kept looking at it. Pauline stood in the hall of Wintermere House in the borrowed coat that she had returned before entering and accepted back, and she looked at the household that had mocked her and dismissed her and enjoyed her fall, and she felt something she did not have an exact word for. It was not triumph. Triumph required enjoyment of another's loss. It was something quieter. The feeling of being seen by enough people who matter, that the ones who didn't no longer have the power to make you invisible. Mrs. Clark appeared at her shoulder with a cup of tea, which she pressed into Pauline's hands without ceremony. "The West Room is ready," she said, "when you want to rest." Pauline looked at her. "Mrs. Clark?" "Yes." Thank you for the 3 years, not just today, Mrs. Clark's expression changed briefly into something that showed the person under the housekeeper. Then it settled back. "The boys will want you in an hour," she said. "Don't be late." 3 nights after Pauline's return, Desmond came to the nursery in the hour between supper and midnight. He did not announce himself. He stood in the doorway, and Pauline saw him before he said anything. And she waited without making the movement toward rises that politeness required, because she had begun, very carefully, to take him at his word on certain things. He entered. He crossed to the cradle. Theodore was awake, watching the ceiling with his usual ferocious focus. Desmond reached down, slowly, with both hands, the way Pauline had once showed him. Palm flat, warmth arriving before the lift, and he lifted Theodore with a care that was slightly unpracticed and entirely deliberate. Theodore startled, fussed, and then, perhaps, because his father was holding him with such concentrated intent, he stilled, not the way he stilled for Pauline, not that immediate, absolute trust. Something more tentative, an infant deciding whether to trust the new. Desmond stood holding his son, with the expression of someone who has been handed something extraordinarily fragile, and is only now beginning to understand what it is. "They were born the night she died," he said. I know this is not their fault. I have never believed it was their fault. But grief does not need logic." He looked at Theodore. "Every time they cried, I heard the night again, the dark, the physician's face, the way the candles," he stopped. His jaw moved once. "I loved them from a distance, because the alternative required standing in the room where she was absent. And I could not." "Your Grace," he looked at Pauline. She was standing on the other side of the cradle, with Arthur warm and quiet against her shoulder, and her voice, when she spoke, was the voice she used for things that needed to be said clearly and without softening. "They did not take her from you," she said. "They are what she left you." The nursery was completely still. Theodore made a small sound against Desmond's shoulder, and Desmond's eyes fell to him, and something moved across his face that was too large and too old to have a name in ordinary language. It was the kind of expression that belongs to the moment when a thing you have been holding at a distance for a very long time finally arrives, and you find that the contact is not what you feared. It is grief, but it is also, finally, after all of this, love without reservation. His shoulders dropped. He pressed his lips briefly, once, to the top of Theodore's head. When he raised his face, his eyes were bright in the candlelight. Pauline was not looking away. This was not the moment for looking away. After a long moment, he said, very quietly, "Will you hum?" She hummed. He held his son and she held the other and the four notes, moved through the warm nursery air, and Arthur's eyes fell closed, and Theodore's fist opened against his father's shoulder, with the small, absolute surrender of an infant, choosing to trust the arms that are holding him. Desmond's eyes closed too, for a moment, just a moment. When they opened, they found Pauline watching him. She did not look away, he did not tell her to. What followed was a season. December into January, January into February. Wintermere House did not transform overnight, because houses do not, and people do not either. But it changed by increments, the way light changes in a room when someone moves the curtains, not suddenly, but decisively. Desmond came to the nursery regularly. He sat with the boys. He learned, with the practiced patience of a man who had decided to learn, the difference between Theodore's tired cry and his hungry one, between Arthur's content silence and his restless silence. He held them. He held them even when they fussed, which was the harder thing, staying when the staying was uncomfortable. He was not immediately good at it. He was persistent. The twins settled into their father slowly and without drama, the way children settle into new things when the new thing presents itself with consistency. Theodore reached for Desmond first. One morning after the second week, both arms lifting with the full and imperious demand of a child who has decided that this particular person's arms are acceptable. Desmond had looked at Pauline when it happened. She had looked back, and she had smiled, and the smile had been the most unguarded thing he had seen from her. And it had reached all the way into him and sat down somewhere he was not yet, ready to call by its name. He walked with her in the garden in the late January thaw, when the ground was wet and the paths were muddy, and Mrs. Clark walked a discreet 10 yards behind them, with the expression of someone who has decided to be a reasonable distance away. He asked her about St. Bridget's. She told him. She told him about the dormitory, and the cold and the children who cried at night, and about her mother, who had been there before her, and had died when Pauline was 7. And about the song that had been the one small thing she had carried out of that place intact. She spoke without self-pity, which was a quality he was beginning to understand as fundamental to her. She did not perform her suffering. She simply described it and went on. He listened, he did not interrupt, he did not offer remedies or pronouncements. He simply walked beside her in the wet garden and listened to her speak. And he felt, as he listened, the particular quality of attention that is both the simplest and the rarest thing one person can offer another. She noticed. She had grown up in a house where no one listened. She had spent 3 years below stairs in a house where she was looked through. She knew, in her bones, the difference between being heard and being tolerated. Desmond Vaughan was listening. One evening, in the library, he brought her a book, not a gift exactly. He had been reading it, and thought she might find it interesting, and he said this plainly, without ceremony, because he had found that ceremony with Pauline did not serve the purpose. She took it. She read 3 chapters that evening in the nursery, after the boys were asleep, and she left him a note tucked inside the front cover. 3 sentences about the 2nd chapter. Which was the most reckless thing she had done in her life up to that point, and she nearly retrieved it 2x before deciding to let it stay. He found it the following morning. He came to the nursery that afternoon, and they talked about the book for 20 minutes before Theodore woke and demanded company, which resolved the question of whether the conversation would end awkwardly by ending it entirely. He left. At the door, he looked back. Tomorrow, he said. Tomorrow, she agreed. March arrived. One evening beside the nursery fire, after the boys were asleep and Mrs. Clark had long since taken herself off to bed, Pauline and Desmond sat in the 2 low chairs, a blanket across both their laps in the careless, unthinking way of people who have stopped tracking the small boundaries. She was reading, he was not. He had been watching the fire, which is what he did when he was thinking about something and hadn't decided yet what he thought about it. He said, "What does peace mean to you?" She lowered the book. "That's a large question for 10:30. A small, brief thing happened at the corner of his mouth that was not quite a smile, but was its ancestor. She considered. "I think peace means being unafraid to be loved," she said at last. "Not the absence of difficulty, just not being afraid of the thing itself." He was quiet. "And you?" she said. "I thought it meant silence," he said. He looked at the fire. "I have been wrong about a number of things this year." The fire moved between them. Their hands rested on the shared blanket, not quite touching, separated by a fold in the wool. "You have been less wrong," she said carefully, "as time has gone on. That is the most restrained compliment I have ever received." She laughed, the real laugh, the quiet, full one that had been the first thing to crack his certainty, months ago, when Theodore had made the face. He looked at her when she laughed. She felt the look before she caught it, the specific quality of it. Not the administrative study of the first weeks. Not the reluctant attention of the middle months. This was different. This was the look of a man who is no longer trying to categorize something, who has given up on categorizing it and is simply seeing it instead. She met his eyes. The fire crackled. Neither of them said anything. After a moment, his hand moved across the fold in the blanket. Just his fingers. Opening slightly, finding her hand without drama, settling over hers with a warmth that was deliberate and asked no more than she was willing to give. Her fingers turned and held his back. They sat like that for a long time without speaking. When she finally rose to check on Arthur, who had stirred briefly, Desmond stood too. He stood in the nursery with the low fire and the sleeping boys and the last of the evening, and he felt something he had not felt in a long time. He felt that he was in the right place. The proposal came in April. Spring had arrived at Wintermere in its particular slow English way, the tulips in the beds and the grass beginning to green, and the long evenings stretching out, with a quality of promise that winter had withheld. The east corridor rooms had been opened in February. Desmond's decision, made one morning and executed that afternoon, before he could think too long about it. Adelaide's things had been sorted with care, her jewelry distributed to her sisters, her dresses given to the village with the deliberateness of a man doing something painful and necessary, and doing it on his own terms. The portrait remained in the nursery. It would stay. The twins were 9 months old, and pulling themselves up against anything that would support their weight, and arguing with each other in a language that existed between them and no one else. Arthur's serious nature had developed into a quality of focused determination that made Mrs. Clark predict, solemnly, that he would either govern a nation or give everyone, around him, a complete nervous breakdown. Theodore had his mother's warmth and his father's stubbornness in equal measure, which was a combination that nobody at Wintermere had the energy to be intimidated by yet. Desmond came to the nursery after supper on a Tuesday. The boys were asleep. Agnes was off. The fire was low and warm. Pauline was at the window with the curtains open, looking at the garden in the long spring evening light. He came in and stood beside her. They looked out at the garden together for a moment. The elm trees were beginning to leaf. The old stone paths were wet from a late afternoon shower. "I have been thinking," he said, "about what you said. That peace means being unafraid to be loved." She was still. "I have been practicing," he said, "being unafraid." She turned her head slightly and looked at him. He was looking at the garden, and then he was looking at her. He turned to face her properly, which meant she had to look up to meet his eyes, and she did. "You came to this house," he said, "because my sons needed comfort. And you gave it, without being asked and without being thanked, and at considerable cost to yourself." He paused. "But I am not asking you to stay for them. They will survive without you as they survived without my presence, and I without theirs. Adequately, poorly, missing the essential thing. Her heart was very loud. I am asking you to stay because I love you, Pauline. His voice was low and direct and entirely unadorned. Not what you have done here. Not what you mean to the boys. You, your courage, your truth, the way you listen, the way you do not pretend things are easier than they are. The way you walked back into this house with your head up after I had veiled you, because you had decided it was the right thing and not because I deserved it. She was quiet for a moment. I need to know, she said, that you understand what the world will say. The world has said a great deal of things that were wrong, he said. I am not afraid of the world's opinion. Your mother has been invited to take up comfortable residence in the Dower House. A pause. She was very unhappy about it. She will recover. Pauline's mouth moved in the beginning of a smile that she held back. I am a parish girl, she said. Without family, without name. I know exactly who you are, Desmond said. I have been paying close attention for some months. She looked at him. I know you favor the second chair from the fire because the warmth is more even there. I know you eat your meals quickly because you grew up in a place where food was not certain. I know you hum even when you think no one is listening. I know you cry for other people's pain and hold your own inside until you are somewhere private. He was watching her face. I know you have never once, in all the time I have been watching, acted from anything less than pure and entire care for the people in your keeping. His voice lowered. I want to be in your keeping, Pauline. I want the right to be in your care and to offer mine in return, properly, permanently. She looked at him for a long time. The spring light was going gold outside the nursery window. Inside, the boys breathed slowly in their cradles. And the fire was low, and the portrait of Adelaide looked out from above the mantel, with those composed dark eyes that held their warmth beneath the surface. Yes, Pauline said. Yes, Desmond. He reached for her hands, both of them. He held them between his carefully, with the same deliberateness with which he had first set his coat on her shoulders in the rain, and he looked at her in the way he had been practicing. Without armor, without the management of distance, fully present, fully here, he raised her hands and pressed his lips to her knuckles. Then he straightened and looked at her, and she looked back at him, and the space between them was no longer the space of station or suspicion or carefully maintained propriety. It was simply the space between two people who have decided. He drew her in, slowly, his hand against her face. And she rose to meet him, and he kissed her with a gentleness that was also a thoroughness, that was also entirely certain, that was. After everything, after all of the distance, and the fear, and the rain, and the ruin, and the four notes, repeated until they became the sound of the house's heart, the simplest thing in the world. From the cradles, Theodore made a small, satisfied sound. Arthur slept through it. Summer came to Wintermere. Long golden evenings, and the smell of cut grass through the open nursery window, and the sound of two boys, 11 months old now, pulling themselves upright, enormously pleased with themselves, arguing about nothing in the language only they spoke, moving through the house that had forgotten warmth and was now remembering it. The wedding had been in May. Small by the standards of what Desmond's title required, and by design, both of them had wanted something true rather than spectacular. The church in the village, the household in attendance, Mrs. Clark in the front row with the expression of someone maintaining composure through an act of will. The dowager had been invited and had not come, which had wounded nobody and inconvenienced nobody, and would perhaps in time resolve itself. Pauline Roberts became Pauline Vaughan, Duchess of Wintermere, on a morning when the apple trees in the kitchen garden were in full bloom, and the twins had been carefully dressed by Agnes in their best linen, and had destroyed it within 30 minutes of arrival at the church, through means that required no explanation. She did not think, standing at the altar, about what she was gaining. She thought about the four notes, and the night she had stepped forward, and the boy from Saint Bridget's in her memory who had cried and not been answered. She thought about cold hands and borrowed coats, and a man who had learned, slowly and without grace and with absolute determination, to be unafraid. She thought, this is what it feels like to not be invisible. That was enough. That was everything. On a long summer evening, the nursery window was open. Pauline was at the window with Arthur, on her hip, showing him the garden. He was studying it with his usual comprehensive attention, pointing at things, the elm trees, a bird, the stone path, with the focused demand of someone who requires names for everything immediately. Theodore was with his father. This was the thing that had changed most completely and most quietly. Desmond sat on the nursery floor, on the floor, in his shirt sleeves, without his coat, in a posture that would have been entirely unrecognizable to anyone who had known him a year ago, with Theodore in his lap, and Theodore's favorite rattle, and an expression of absolute absorption in the small person currently using his waistcoat as a climbing surface. Theodore reached his father's shoulder and looked down from this great height with the expression of a man who has achieved the summit. Desmond reached up and caught him before he could attempt the descent. He held his son. He looked at Pauline. She looked back, Arthur still on her hip, the summer evening, behind her. He had been standing outside the door for 14 months. He came in now. He came home. In the nursery of Wintermere House, on a summer evening that smelled of grass and open windows, a poor maid who had been rejected by everyone held a duke's son on her hip, and the duke himself sat on the floor with his other son in his lap, and neither the title nor the station nor the years of distance and grief and cold corridors mattered at all any more. What mattered was the sound of the house. Wintermere House was quiet. Not the silence of grief. Not the silence of avoidance. The silence of a place that has finally, after everything, remembered how to be at rest. The boys were not crying. They had everything they needed. So did he. So did she. If Pauline's story touched your heart, give this video a thumbs up and subscribe so you never miss a new story. Share it with someone who loves a beautiful love story. And drop a comment below. I would love to know which moment stayed with you the most. See you in the next one.